Building the Impossible Railroad. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
People have been talking about a railroad to Key West for 50 years. It was always dismissed as completely impossible.
Henry Flagler could very well be credited for opening up the Sunshine State to the rest of the U.S. His railroad ran from Jacksonville through West Palm Beach, Miami, and eventually to Key West. We'll hear the story of Flagler and his dream to build the Impossible Railroad. Also, Chile just elected the youngest president ever at the age of 35, who's also very progressive. We'll learn more about him. And finally, the southernmost landmark has been restored after two vandals tried to destroy it. We'll hear how an unexpected source helped capture the culprits. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. You know, there was a time when the only way to get to Key West was by boat. And then came the oil and rail magnate, Henry Flagler. His railroad opened the east coast of Florida to the rest of the country. He helped develop West Palm Beach and Miami. But his most ambitious dream was to extend his railroad all the way to Key West over difficult terrain and open waters. Author Les Standiford teaches writing at Florida International University, and he wrote the book about Flagler's dream. It came out in 2002. It's called Last Train to Paradise, Henry Flagler and the Spectacular Rise and Fall of the Railroad That Crossed an Ocean. It's our Sundial Book Club pick for the month of January, and you can join our book club on Facebook. Now, we spoke with Les last week about where the idea to write this book came from and a bunch of stories about Flagler's exploits. This came out in the early 2000s, and I was wondering, what was going on around that time, you know, in your life and around Miami? Why'd you want to tell this story?
The reason it's almost a fluke that I wrote this book in the first place. I was writing novels, and my agent, I had published six of them, and my agent came to town for Christmas and had Christmas dinner with us and told me that he was flying to Key West the next day with his wife. And I said, oh, geez, Scott, you ought to drive. It's such a beautiful, gorgeous drive. And he said, really? Is it a long one? I said, but it's a pretty one. So they canceled their plane flight. They drove down. They returned to have New Year's Eve dinner with us. And he was just bubbling over with what he'd seen on the trip down, and then what he'd learned at the Hemingway Museum at the Hemingway House in Key West. And he said, geez, there used to be a railroad down there and the storm blew it all away. And that's a fascinating story. I said, yeah, everybody down here knows about it, Scott. And he said, but I'm from New York and I've never heard a word of it. And I said, well, anyway, I'm glad I told you to take the drive. And he said, no. What I'm getting at is you need to write this story. I said, but Scott, I'm a novelist. And he said, listen, a good story is a good story, whether it's true or made up. And he had me there. And then he said the magic words. He said, besides, I think I can sell it. The difference he explained to me between writing novels and nonfiction is that you can write what's called a proposal for a nonfiction book, maybe a chapter with a sample chapter in it. And instead of spending a year or a year and a half out of your life finding if somebody wants it, they'll send this proposal around because people in New York have an idea of what will interest nonfiction writers. So they don't have any idea what's going to interest a novel writer and unless your name's Anne Rice or something. So I said, well, I'll give it a shot. And lo and behold, two publishers were bidding against each other immediately for this thing, which was certainly a first in my career. And besides, at that point, I'd done enough preliminary research to really get in to realize that I knew very little of the story. Like Paul Harvey used to say, and he had a program called The Rest of the Story.
Oh, yeah.
It'd give you a little teaser and about, you know, and that woman was Abraham Lincoln's wife. And in just a moment, I'll be back to tell you the rest of the story.
How long did it take the research to gather to put it together?
I suppose I overdid it. It took me about a year and a half altogether. About half of that was research and half writing, and there was some more research when I got into places where I realized I didn't have everything I needed, and I would go back. I would travel down to the Keys. I'd talk to one person, and then they'd call me up and say, "Hey, you ought to talk to old so-and-so," and like that. So about a year and a half to write the book.
So when you think about the story and what Henry Flagler wanted to do, obviously eventually stretch his railroad all the way down to Key West, because he had an idea of what Key West would become, but we'll get to that in a minute. But was Florida, especially South Florida, destined for growth and population expansion? Even if Henry Flagler had not built that railroad, do you think it would have happened anyway?
Well, of course. Obviously, we would have grown and grown mightily, because what's not to like down here, I want you to know. And the same things that draw people, the beauty of the climate, and now the very diversity of cultures and food, this is like the American Casablanca down here. That would have all occurred sooner or later, just by where dint of where we sit in the climate and the beauty of the place. But Flagler was the man who did it, and he did it when he did it. Who knows how long it would have been before South Florida was discovered, but he's the guy who brought the railroad here, and with it, civilization. For that matter, he made the whole East Coast of Florida possible. You could have drawn a line when he moved to St. Augustine, from St. Augustine across to Tampa, and everything south of that line would have had a big stamp like the map makers used to put, terra incognita, because there wasn't anything there until you got to Key West. Key West had always been a thriving, basically Caribbean port, but it was detached from Florida, had no real connection to Florida.
Mm. You know, one of the things I loved about the book is you had quite a few different people's descriptions of Henry Flagler from his time, people from his era writing about him in there. But what you know about him, how would you describe him?
Oh, he was a workaholic. This comes from his, probably as a result of his penniless childhood and an ingrained desire to succeed. And that never goes away with a lot of people. And I don't think it ever did with him. I mean, I think that's to explain why at age 75, he would undertake the building of the railroad, the last link of it, from Miami to Key West across 155 miles of largely water. And there was no other practical explanation for it, except that he was also stubborn and prideful. And I think that when people got wind of the rumor that he was going to do this and scoffed at it, Flagler's folly, they called it, part of his motivation was to prove that, by George, he could do it, and he would do it.
Did he take that personal when they called it Flagler's folly?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He was a very proud guy. He had come to thinking, calling Florida my domain, because in his eyes, he'd made the whole thing possible. At least, as I say, the eastern half of the state possible by bringing the railroad there and allowing people to establish farms where they could grow crops and send them send the fruits back on the railroad to allow people to travel and enjoy the beauty of the beaches. He took great. This is a guy who spent the first 52 years of his life as an extractor of oil. He was the partner of John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil, and he went really from an exploiter to a developer, to a creator. Yeah. And with these hotels and making cities possible. And that gave him immense pride. So yes, when people started to make fun of him at his age 75, after all he had done, it did rank.
We're talking with Les Standiford, author of numerous books. For today, though, we're talking about his 2002 book, The Last Train to Paradise, Henry Flagler, and the Spectacular Rise and Fall of the Railroad That Crossed an Ocean. You can read more about Les and about the book on our Facebook page, Sundial Book Club, free to join. Just ask to join, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on the book as well. And you talk about that, you know, working with Rockefeller, and I wondered, of the two, who is more influential? Could you say there was an alpha in between those two?
Well, people in the Northeast would scoff at the question. They'd say, well, of course it was Rockefeller and Rockefeller Plaza, and we know the Rockefellers and all the Rockefellers that have remained influential clear down to the, you know, into the 20th century and so forth. But Rockefeller never did anything like make a state possible. But Henry Flagler did.
And the relationship, it started because of oil. They were both working together.
Oh, yeah. They met even before oil. Rockefeller started off as a grain broker in Cleveland. He bought, you know, large quantities of grain from consortiums of farms and the like. And one of the men that he bought from was Henry Flagler, working as the grain broker for a local store in northeastern Ohio. And over around Toledo, and they became friends. And then Flagler went into the salt business up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, knowing nothing about salt, but thinking he was going to make a fortune selling it to the Union Army during the Civil War. And he went promptly broke and lost every bit of his money and the money he'd borrowed from friends and family. And he came back to Cleveland and asked Rockefeller for a job. Because he needed to pay these people back. And Rockefeller said, well, I'll give you a job, Henry, but it's not going to be in grain. We're going to into oil, which nobody knew about at the time. And it was a substitute. It wasn't even a fuel. It was a substitute for whale oil in lamps. And people were just beginning to drill for it and bring it out of the ground. And Flagler and Rockefeller went into business. And in Rockefeller's own autobiography, he credits Flagler as being the brains behind the outfit. It was Flagler who figured out how to negotiate all the favorable rail contracts for bringing the crude oil from the wellhead to the refineries, and also for incorporating basically the same company in separate states to get around antitrust law. Yeah. So that earned him the undying ire of Theodore Roosevelt. But he was the guy who figured out how to make Standard Oil the empire that it was.
And they both became two of the richest men in the history of the country. What led Flagler? Because you said, I mean, he finishes his career as a developer. What led him from going from oil to becoming the rail man, and you kind of just touched on it, but really the developer of Florida?
Well, it was a mistake, a fluke again. He came to St. Augustine the first time with his first wife, who had tuberculosis, and the doctors thought perhaps the winter climate in Florida would help her out, and it did. And she seemed to rally, and so the following winter they were going to come back and stay in St. Augustine again, but she took seriously sick and died. And Flagler remarried pretty quickly, shortly after her death, to one of the women who took care of her. There's a little controversy about that. But he remarried Ida Alice Shewards, and they went back to St. Augustine on their honeymoon. And Ida liked St. Augustine, but she didn't particularly think the hotel was very much. And so Flagler did what anybody with his money would do. He bought the hotel, tore it down, and rebuilt in its place the Ponce de Leon Hotel. And that's how it began. Then they also didn't appreciate, you had to change trains three times between Jacksonville and St. Augustine. And you, who've gone to school at at Flagler College, I believe,
yep.
can appreciate, wait, you have to change trains three times to get from St. Augustine to Jacksonville? But you did, because it was different lines with different gauge track, and you'd go for a few miles, and you'd have to get off on another. Anyway, Flagler bought all those railroads, turned it into one, which eventually called the Florida East Coast Railroad, so you could get easily to his hotel from Penn Station, for that matter. Well-to-do people from the Northeast could get on to Penn Station, and 2 days later, they'd be steps from the water in the Ponce de Leon in Jacksonville.
So he
just continued that process from city to city to Palm Beach to Miami, finally to Key West, on down the east coast of the state.
Yeah, and the interesting thing too, I've been dying to ask you this question. So yeah, he from St. Augustine down to Daytona Beach, and eventually he comes down to Palm Beach, thinking at one point that's where he was going to stop. But then Julia Tuttle tries to convince him, no, bring it down to Miami. And at first, right. he wasn't really sold on that idea. Miami was nothing at the time. And, you know, we think of Julia Tuttle, obviously, as the founder of the city of Miami. But I have to ask you, who do you think played a bigger role in the creation of Miami? Was it Julia Tuttle or was it Henry Flagler?
Oh, you know, there's a story that Julia, after a big hard freeze swept way south in Florida, further than it had in years, and killed all the citrus crops, that except in Miami, that Julia Tuttle sent a bough of unfrosted orange blossoms up to Flagler in Palm Beach and said, look, Miami is, if there was ever a frost-proof place, this is it. Bring your railroad to Miami, Mr. Flagler. And that may be an apocryphal story. I'm sure that that word reached Flagler that the freeze had not killed the crops in Miami, and Julia Tuttle might have been the one that made that happen. Whether or not there was an armload of blossoms ever delivered, nobody really can say for sure. But if she, what really sealed the deal was that she convinced another settler in Miami to give half, she said, I'll donate half of my homestead, 320 of my 640 acres. Donate your 320 from yours, and we'll give it to Flagler in return for bringing the railroad to Miami. And wow. I think that's really, what truly made it happen, that Flagler, with the promise of that for a site for a depot and a hotel again, decided to do it.
Okay, so he finally brings the rail to Miami, and of course Miami starts to grow from there. As you had said earlier, Key West has always been a very big port, but very separated from the rest of Florida.
You can only get there by boat.
Right. What was it that convinced Henry Flagler, yeah, I'll stretch this rail all the way down there?
Well, people have been talking about a railroad to Key West for 50 years, back into the 19th century. But it was kind of like talking about, we can put a McDonald's franchise on the moon. It was always dismissed. It was completely impossible and unfeasible. Even if you could do it, it would cost too much to ever recoup your investment. And but two or three companies had applied for and received a franchise that would lapse from the state to do so. Nobody ever turned over a spadeful of earth before Flagler. Flagler had been talked to by boosters and developers of one sort from the 1890s who thought it was possible. But when it was announced in 1905 that the United States was going to take over and complete the building of the Panama Canal, then Flagler began to think seriously about it, because he reasoned that if he dredged a deep water port in Key West, that would be the closest one to the eastern terminus of the canal, and the ships would obviously dock there, take on fuel, and offload some of their cargo for distribution by his railroad.
I don't want to give anything away. People need to read it, because you beautifully, you know, stretch out the story of how he brings the railroad through the Keys. We take for granted because we could drive that road, but what life was like back then and the challenges. I do want to ask you this, though. What was the greatest challenge for him and engineers to get that thing done? Because they did get to the Keys, to Key West, but what was the biggest challenge?
Well, he wasn't sure that the engineering capability was there to erect bridges, some of them, going for 6 miles, as we know, or 7 miles. He wasn't sure that the technology existed to do that. And he called in, he had built the Ponce de Leon, however, out of a new building medium called reinforced concrete. That made the same concept that made skyscrapers eventually possible, or tall buildings first before iron girders, that it was concrete poured into forms that were reinforced with iron rebar, and that allowed the Ponce de Leon to go up to, to be a multi-story building. Whereas before you build a wall of bricks, the very weight of it would likely cause it to collapse. Well, that worked out at the Ponce de Leon and some other buildings that he built. And he called this engineer in who just finished building a series of seaport docks for the Mexican government down in the Veracruz Peninsula, and said, do you think that, I know you built these docks, could you also build a series of viaduct-style bridges that would cross these large open expanses that are subject to tides and storms that would withstand them? What do you think? And George Meredith, who we're talking about, said, well, I think we can, Mr. Flagler. And Flagler's reply was, well, then go to Key West, Mr. Meredith. And off they went.
Was he, because, reading through the story, and this is history I didn't know, but how did he treat his workers? And these were such difficult working conditions already, but there was a lot of criticism about how he treated workers, and yet he did go down and watch and see what was happening, and he saw the challenges they faced and tried to make it a little more comfortable. But in the end, though, how did he treat all of his workers?
Well, I think Flagler truly was a pragmatist. He knew, like a general knows, that an army travels on its stomach. And if you don't treat your men well, then you're not going to accomplish the objective. The biggest problems came in terms of attitude came from people who hired on, hearing about this easy money to be made down in Florida, who got there and realized just how difficult it is to dig into limestone marl with a pick and a shovel. As we who live here know, it's almost impossible. And there was no heavy equipment. It mostly got done on the backs of laborers. What particularly rankled them was they got free transportation down, but if they quit, the company didn't pay their transportation back. So in essence, they were stuck, and they complained they were being held prisoner in the Keys and things like that. All of it eventually became a suit, which was tossed out, but it was not easy work. And in hindsight, you can say, boy, Flagler took advantage of certain, he used prison labor, contracted prison labor, guys who had to work and, made their pennies, if anything, for their work. But so did a lot of people. The context matters there. There's no one of the things that Flagler did do in a positive light, one of the first hurricanes that hit the Keys while the railroad was being constructed swept away one of the dormitory houseboats on which 100 men were hiding, sheltering from the storm. Well, the winds broke it loose from its mooring, swept it out to sea, dashed to pieces on the reefs of those shallow waters, and most of them drowned. Well, the reason they used houseboats was it was cheap. They could, when they finished working in one place, they could just float them on down further south and wouldn't have to build new barracks. Well, after that terrible tragedy, Flagler said, well, there'll be no more of that. We will build permanent living quarters as we go, no matter what the cost is. We're not going to have another calamity like that. Now, there are other examples of him taking pains to make sure that the workers were fed well and got good medical care, because, as I said, if nothing else, it was a practical matter. Wasn't like you were building something in a city where there was an endless supply of labor. Most of the people who worked on this job came from somewhere else. Yeah. Miami was still only a population of 1,000 people. So he had to be reasonable. And just in terms of his racial attitudes, there's no evidence that Flagler was, I don't know what he believed about people of color in his heart of hearts, probably what most everybody else did, that white people were somehow smarter, the chosen race, who knows? But there's no evidence that he ever behaved that way or of any prejudicial actions on his part.
So fascinating that he understood, you know, there were certain things that workers needed. Granted, he was also strict on no liquor, no ladies. We're talking with Les Standiford, author of numerous books. For today, though, we're talking about his 2002 book, The Last Train to Paradise, Henry Flagler, and the Spectacular Rise and Fall of the Railroad That Crossed an Ocean. You can read more about Les and about the book on our Facebook page, Sundial Book Club, free to join. Just ask to join, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on the book as well. What do you think his legacy was after the 1935 Labor Day storm pretty much ended the dream of the railroad, but what was his legacy right after that and how it's changed over the decades?
Well, I don't think to this day, I think Flagler's, compared to Rockefeller, for instance, pretty much an unknown figure. Even in Florida, people know about Flagler Boulevard or Flagler College, and they really don't have much of an understanding who Flagler is. For one thing, so many people have come to Florida from somewhere else that what history they might know of a place is probably the one that they came from. But that's one of the reasons why I'm gratified that this book lives on. This is a book that was published in 2002, Luis, and it's now nearing its 40th printing, 20 years later. That usually doesn't happen to books. My novels had the shelf life of a quart of milk. I get letters. I get a letter a week from somebody who's read this book and said, gee whiz, who knew? To a certain extent, Flagler's is an underappreciated legacy. He was roundly celebrated right after the railroad made it to Key West, after he finally wrote his own iron to Key West in 1912, but he died less than a year later after that. In his day, he was seen as the person who made this whole the operation of Florida basically possible. But by the time of the Depression, the railroad as a whole was almost bankrupt. Florida had a terrible black eye because of the scams having to do with land development in the 20s, and where people had lost so much money. Nobody was coming here. And by the time the servicemen started to move back after World War II to a place where they'd been trained, everybody kind of forgotten about Flagler. It didn't change very much in the next 50, 60, 70 years.
You know what? It's his imprint is pretty much all over the place. And I've lived in Florida for almost 40 years, and I could spot those places. I wanted to finish with this, Les. I wanted to move over to your newest book, because again, this one, as you said, it's 40th edition, but your newest book, and I just started reading it, The Big Battle for the Big Top, the story of Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. And I have to ask why you wanted to write this story, but give us a quick synopsis of what the story is.
It's the story of the basically of the development of the American circus into the most popular form of entertainment in the country, the position that it enjoyed for about 150 years. And it's another one of those, you know, it's really the story is Bailey versus Barnum versus Ringling versus Father Time. That's basically how it goes. And it's another one of those stories where I, when I began, when the circus announced it was closing, the last of the grand circuses in 2017, I was sad for emotional reasons, but I began to think, why am I sad? Is it just because I like lions, elephants, tigers, and acrobats? And I began to look into it, and I realized, no, it's far more than that. For so many years, the circus was so popular because it truly reflected something essential about who we were. And basically, that is that people came to the United States, from the United States was created from the beginning out of the concept that anything is possible, that a human being with enough, with some talent and with hard work and with persistence can accomplish anything. And going to the circus of an afternoon and watching what people, the amazing things that persons could do, you know, there are no special effects in the circus.
Right.
It's not a magic show. Every amazing thing that happens there really takes place. And that's what finally drove me to see that book become a reality.
Listen, I just started reading it, and the little history I know, you want to talk about three fascinating characters. You mentioned them. I'm looking forward to the rest of this one. Les, it's been such a pleasure. I always enjoy having you on and sharing great stories of Florida history. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Luis.
Again, that's author Les Standifer, the January author for the Sundog Book Club. His book is Last Train to Paradise, Henry Flagler and the Spectacular Rise and Fall of the Railroad that Crossed an Ocean. Learn more about it. Join the Facebook page, Sundog Book Club. It's free. We'd love to have you. Well, still to come, Chile just elected a young progressive president. What does that mean for the future of the conservative country? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Chile is one of the most prosperous countries in Latin America, and for a long time, it was considered one of the region's most conservative. Now it seems to be headed in a new direction towards becoming one of the most progressive with the help of its new president and from expats from South Florida. WLRN's America's editor Tim Padgett brings us this story.
Suma aruma pun mai Chile!
Last month, left-wing candidate Gabriel Boric became the youngest person ever to be elected president of Chile. He's 35, and he beat far-right-wing candidate José Antonio Kast, who's 20 years older, in a landslide. Boric's youth and his liberal politics represent something larger happening in Chile. It was long considered one of Latin America's most conservative countries. Now it's becoming one of its most progressive.
Finally, Chile woke up. We need to take Chile to the 21st century.
José Ignacio Valenzuela, known as Chascas, is an acclaimed Chilean screenwriter and author of young adult books, including his best-selling Mal Amor trilogy. He lives here in Palmetto Bay with his husband and their daughter. Valenzuela is an expat, but he played a big role in the Chilean Congress's legalization of gay marriage last month. Under previous Chilean law, as a gay father, he couldn't visit Chile with his daughter because he wouldn't be able to leave Chile with her.
Because the Chilean constitution didn't recognize two fathers. They would ask me for permission from the mother to take out of the country a child. That's a huge problem for LGBTQ families. So I decided to get loud.
Valenzuela waged a fervent campaign in Chilean media, like this online interview, which helped push gay marriage over the top. Chileans have held street protests in recent years demanding similar social reforms, like this massive march in the capital, Santiago, in 2019. Those have led to a more decisive break with the era of Augusto Pinochet's brutal right-wing dictatorship. It ended in 1990, but Valenzuela says it's taken three decades for Chile to discard Pinochet's reactionary legacy.
Pinochet left us with a very scary constitution, and we finally are going to get rid of that constitution.
Chileans recently voted to write a new constitution. Chile is Latin America's most prosperous economy, but its current constitution has greatly favored the interests of a rich, powerful elite. Supporters say the new charter will be more democratic. The convention drafting it includes ethnic minorities, indigenous people, and an equal number of men and women. It'll address women's issues such as abortion rights. That's more possible now that Chile's Roman Catholic Church has lost clout due to sexual abuse scandals.
Now I can say, let's talk about abortion. 15 years ago, it was like, oh my God, why do you want to talk about this?
Carolina Avaria Quilot is a Chilean expat living in Pinecrest. She teaches history and hosts programs from Miami for Chilean broadcast outlets. She spoke with me from Viña del Mar, Chile. Avaria is quick to point out she's not a liberal. She was raised in Chile in what she calls a super conservative family. She did not support the left-wing winner Gabriel Boric in last month's Chilean presidential election, and personally, she still opposes broadly legalized abortion.
Abortion for me is still, you know, maybe it's going to take me more time, but for me, it's hard dealing with it.
Still, Avaria is glad it's no longer a taboo subject. She feels that's good for women's progress in Chile, which she does support. Her aunt, Wanda Quilot, is one of the first women to do scientific research in Antarctica.
She was absolutely avant-garde. If you take a book of Chilean history, you don't have many women there. But now we are more able to express ourselves, to believe in ourselves.
Avaria credits 21st century phenomena like globalization for more widely opening Chile, once an isolated outpost in South America, to the outside world.
Now we are more open-minded. I like this new Chile.
In Miami, Chilean expats like Juan Nunez say it's heartening to hear Chilean conservatives like Avaria speak that way. Nunez and his more politically liberal family left Chile in the 1970s, when he was a student, to escape the Pinochet dictatorship. I'm seeing a more moderate, a more civilized right emerging in Chile, Nunez told me. Today, Nunez owns a successful exterminating company in Miami with his brother, and he hopes Chile's economic inequality will finally be fixed. But Chile's new liberal wave is also causing some anxiety. At least two Chilean law firms recently opened offices in Miami to help wealthy, more conservative Chileans move here.
You just heard last week's Latin America Report with WLRN's America's editor, Tim Padgett. This week, he looks at how things are in Cuba. The island's regime has begun more trials from last summer's street protests and are cracking down on one specific city that's historically been at the forefront of revolt in Cuba. Now, you can find more of the Latin America Report on our social media, WLRN Sundial, and you can listen to the latest episode on air during All Things Considered later today. And by the way, don't forget that you could stay in touch with us. The best way to do it, the Sundial Text Club. Send us your thoughts, your comments, your questions about anything you hear on the program. Start by just texting the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. We'd love to have you join. Well, still to come, we're going to get the crazy story behind solving who vandalized the southernmost point landmark in Key West. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. All right, who cracked the case of the burned buoy? That's how our recent story from Florida Keys reporter Gwen Filosa starts. New Year's Day, the southernmost point landmark in Key West was scarred and burned by a fire. Video footage caught some men damaging the big buoy, but help figuring out who the men were and how to catch them came from an unlikely source. Gwen is the Keys reporter for Florida Keys News and the Miami Herald. She joins us now live. Gwen, great to have you back.
Hi, thank you.
All right, tell us the story of what happened here. I understand there was drinking involved. Go ahead, tell me the rest.
Well, according to the police report and the bar staff at Irish Kevin's, a bar right there on Duval Street in the middle of everything on New Year's Eve, when it comes to drinking and partying, two people were at Irish Kevin's And the next day when the video, a webcam captured every detail of the people setting a fire right by the buoy and the flames going up. And the bartender awoke to see the video online, and he immediately knew he had served them the night before. So he contacted his boss, and they went looking for receipts and security camera video at the bar, and quickly had a suspect's name.
And by the way, it's not the first time this webcam has captured a crime, right?
It's not. No, there was a... last year, a horrible, violent sexual assault that was partially, you could see the suspect on the webcam. Mm.
If I'm not mistaken, in this case of the two vandals of the buoy, a case of rum was offered as a reward?
Yes, the Conch Republic, which a little nation of Key West. They gave him a case of rum from a local distillery we have down here, and gave him an honorary membership as a member of the Conch Republic. And he got some rum cakes and like a flag too. So he was celebrated as a hero.
I got to say, I've never heard of a reward like that, but hey, you know what? It's not a bad reward.
It's a lot of rum.
Yeah, I can imagine. You described the vandalism of the buoy landmark as, quote, striking a nerve on the island of Key West. What do you mean by that?
Yes, we're very lucky. We don't have a lot of crime, and something this kind of high profile to happen. People love the buoy. Key West locals are very, this is very much at its heart a very small town. It's a little like Mayberry with a lot of bars, and people, we're very upset to see something like this happen, and something that just kind of bizarre and unexplainable.
And again, you talk about it because like Mayberry, you know, and you don't have a lot of those kind of stories, but where do you think this event ranks, you know, within the community of like anything else that's happened there?
Oh, it's up there. People were there. The online comments, people were furious over this, and very took it very personally that this landmark was messed up. And it did cause like more than $5,000 in damage, and city leaders scrambled to fix it because that's a big draw. People line up for very patiently and will wait a long time to take their picture in front of the buoy.
And, you know, you talk about, again, the webcam and how that helped, but social media played a big role too. I mean, I remember seeing this on Twitter all over the place.
Yeah, huge role because of the police. I mean, the bartender and the bar general manager, they, you know, of course, contacted police and turned over the information and evidence. And police, you know, found him right on social media. One of the young men had two Instagram accounts. And they were pretty easy to, those days are over, not being able to be found quickly online.
I'm talking with Florida Keys News and Miami Herald reporter Gwen Filosa. We're talking about that famous Key West landmark, the big southernmost buoy. You can see photos on our social media, WLRN Sundial. And share your thoughts with us on this story. Show us your southernmost point selfies, by the way. What does that landmark mean to you if you live in Key West? I really want to know all about that. You know, Gwen, this isn't the first time, by the way, that buoy has been at the center of some controversy or damage to it. But, you know, what else has happened to that buoy? What else has it been through?
Well, way before my time, I was told that it took a lot of graffiti and people carving stuff into it. And it was, but I've been here 10 years and it's people have learned to leave it alone. And it is it's hand painted, so it's super nice. Like it's really nicely. It's very. It's a beautiful kind of old school rendition of Key West.
And by the way, how long has that been there? When did they put that in?
It went up. I believe it was 85. I hope I don't get that. Early 80s, and it was planted there. Big ceremony. Everybody came out to celebrate it, and I was told it cost about $900 to.
Oh, how times have changed. But you know, I mean, you think about the pride that, you know, locals have for it. What does it mean to you?
Oh, the buoy. It always just reminds me that I live in an amazing place whenever I pass by. It's where you go when the hurricanes are churning up, and you can see the waves splash. And everyone loves that photo of the waves crashing over the buoy. And it's just a Key West charm, big charm.
I'll be the first to admit, I mean, I've seen it plenty of times. I've never had a picture taken with it because every time I go by, there is a long line to get to it. I'm just
very long.
And I'm just
people don't cut.
I'm not patient, but that's me. You know, WLRN's Keys reporter, Nancy Klinger, she writes our Keys newsletter called The Tie Line, and she described the recent buoy events this way. Let's take a listen.
Like a lot of locals, I make snarky remarks about out-of-town TV crews who show up there for hurricanes. But I like that it's there and that it is undeniably ours, even if others try to imitate it. It's tough, even when it takes a beating from a Category 4 hurricane or a couple drunk dudes with a lighter. Key West has a conch shell on the city seal, but so do a lot of other local agencies and institutions. Maybe they should consider updating it with the southernmost point.
What do you think of that? Do you have any ideas of your own, Gwen, for elevating the southernmost point of Key West culture?
Yeah, Nancy did a beautiful job explaining it. And the southernmost point, I mean, it is a symbol of Key West. It's on a lot of souvenirs that you can buy. And maybe it should have its own flag and be something that people can wave outside of their homes.
By the way, and you were close. You said that you know, it was installed in the 80s. It was 1983. Yeah,
I googled 83.
There we go. You know, I mean, the other thing too is this. I wondered, with everything that it's been through, has there ever been conversation about maybe protecting it more? I mean, I know it's so popular with people wanting to go up and take a picture, but at the same time, as important as it is, I don't know. Has that ever been discussed?
Not to my knowledge, but I think it will be now. I think it might come up that, I've been here a while and it's always been left alone and respected. And this was certainly a bizarre way of, the gentleman did tell police that they made a mistake and that they didn't mean to hurt the buoy, but that tree was put right beside it and lit the pine tree, and it went up fast.
And by the way, were they locals? They weren't locals.
No,
they were outsiders.
No, I did call it too. I called Florida and Texas, Leesburg, Florida, for one, and Henrietta, Texas, for the other.
Okay,
I'm very proud of that.
I would not imagine that anybody local would do it, but I just, you know, or anybody from the
they'd
Keys.
Have to move.
I know. I know. That's just incredible. I guess really, when you think about this, because you go back to how this story played out, and it was the bartender who, you know, helps find them. I guess the moral of the story, right, is if you order a drink at a bar, tip the bartender.
And exactly, yes, the absence of tip, that's why the bartender remembered them three times. He served the Skylar Jacobson three times, and there was no tip. And they down here, it's a tip in town, and people will remember. Well, don't tip. Stands out.
Oh my goodness. It is a fascinating story. And again, because you have to think about the fact that, again, you know, Key West being a small community, and as you said, it's not like there are a lot of these, the typical Miami stories that you hear. You don't hear that there. It's a lot more quiet and relaxed. When something like this happens, I know a lot of outsiders may laugh, but it's important. And that one piece that stands there means so much to the community. That much I know, every time I go down there, it's a source of pride.
I agree with you. You are correct. And it's just something people want to maintain it. And people want to be respected too. You know, Key West is people go way back here. Been here a long time.
Let's hope that they don't change anything and people are allowed to keep going up to take pictures with it, that we can get close to it. As a coworker always used to say, you know, sometimes that's why we can't have nice things when you have people like this.
it does raise that question, but yeah, I think it brought a lot of people together and reminded us all of that we're very lucky to live here.
Let's all just, you know, I don't know. I won't say anything else. Thankfully, they caught him, and let's hope that doesn't happen again. Gwen Filosa again with the Florida Keys News and Miami Herald. Gwen, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And again, don't forget, you can share your southernmost point selfies with us. And if you are from Key West, love to hear your thoughts on why you believe it is such an important landmark for Key West. That's our program for this Tuesday, January 18th, 2022. Katie Munoz is our lead producer. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Happy birthday, Katie, by the way. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. Jessica Bakeman is our senior news editor. WLRN's interim program director and technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. The theme music for the program is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo at gopalo.com. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk to a couple of local experts who are searching for lost black cemeteries across South Florida. Plus, how one bill moving through the legislature might help preserve them once they're found. All of that tomorrow on the show. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe. Take care of each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.